Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 13th, 1998. In the fireside room this morning is Terence Fretheim. Session number is 98-1, and it's titled, The God of the Old Testament. What's at stake? Let's listen in.
I have a couple of things that I'm supposed to say for the sake of the people on the other end of this microphone. We're ready to start. And this topic is the God of the Old Testament, what's at stake? I'm Terry Fretheim. I teach Old Testament at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. It's good to be with you. Look forward to these times together. This week, talking about God, just one of the small topics that the church has. A colleague and I, who together have taught a course entitled God, and so people pass God and withdraw from God, and it's the most interesting folks are those who audit God. Indicated this morning in the brief readout, it's not enough to say that you believe in God. What matters finally is the kind of God in whom you believe. It's crucial, absolutely crucial, for the life you live, for the way in which your faith is shaped out in daily life. As we hope we'll show also, it makes an awful lot of difference in terms of how you think about the outreach programs of the church, evangelism in the church, how you think about styles of leadership in the church, how you think about children, the faith of children, and developing images of God for children. In other words, how to be a Sunday school teacher and write Sunday school materials. It has an amazing impact in a variety of ways in the life of faith, and so I'm concerned about that question. What kind of God do you believe in? Okay. What kind of God? All sorts of people believe in God. My wife and I now have a Muslim son-in-law. They believe in God. Why do they believe in God? Okay. One of the issues quickly on the table is, what kind of God do you believe in? Make a difference into your life. Now, I think I should begin because this is, please, come on in. There are some chairs over here. Enable you to get a little bit more familiar with me and sort of begin. We're not going to get into the text much today. Starting tomorrow, we will kind of lay the groundwork. What's at stake? Get some of the issues out. Get you to thinking and talking about some of these matters. And I thought I should say something about my approach to the Bible, some sort of basic stuff about the Bible, biblical interpretation initially, as we've done very quickly, because we do want to get on to the God stuff and not just simply issues of the authority of the Bible, but let me sort of give you 10 remembrances, not 10 commandments, there's 10 remembrances in terms of approaching the Bible, and very quick. Okay. Who you are, number one, who you are will affect how you read the Bible. Who you are, whether you're male or female, a middle class, other class, your ethnic background, the type of religious background that you have, the type of the area of the country you come from, whatever, the amount of education you've had, who you are is going to affect how you read the Bible. It's going to affect your interpretation of texts. It's one of the basic reasons why we Christians differ so much from one another, as we have, because we're different folks and we read the Bible in different ways. A second remembrance is that no Bible passage has a single meaning. No Bible passage has a single meaning. Text means all kinds of things. One of the reasons for that is, say, metaphors. You call God parent. Huh? Why that? How do you claim a single meaning for God as parent, God as father. I mean, you use the language of parent for God, and it opens up a world of meaning. It doesn't close it down to a single meaning. Okay? Or there is in text what we call gapping. You're reading the parables of Jesus. You're reading a story in Genesis, whatever, and there's something missing in the story. You've got to fill it in yourself. Huh? And that's a part of interpretation, which is called gapping. You fill in the gaps. Huh? And because you are who you are, and I am who I am, we're going to fill in the gaps in a little different way. And so a third important remembrance is this. Always remember to talk about your interpretation within a community. To share the meaning you discern in text with the meanings that other people have discerned in text. Remember that that interpretation of text is always an interactive reality. It's an interactive reality. It involves you and who you are in all of its complexity. Second, it involves the Holy Spirit at work in you. And then third, it involves the text. But because you're an integral part of the interpretive process, something of who you are will become a part of the meaning of the text that you discern. Now that's scary. That's scary. But that's to let you know that because I'm white, I'm male, I grew up in a parsonage, I've been teaching seminarians for 30 years, I have a Muslim son-in-law, all of these go into shaping who I am. And so you need to take that into account and relate it to who you are and others whom you know who are working with the biblical material. A fourth thing, very quickly, remember that the Bible was written in times and places different from our own. We need always to remember that reading the Bible is a cross-cultural experience. And these are different worlds. And when we're reading the Old Testament, we need constantly intention are these realities. That our knowledge, we know that these texts are pre-Christian. The Old Testament was written by people who weren't Christians. On the other hand, as Christians, we've experienced these texts as speaking a word of God to us. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He picked me. We've experienced these pre-Christian texts as word of God. And so that tension then between an ancient text that's pre-Christian and yet at the same time those texts becoming an integral part of who we are in shaping our life is important. What do we got? Fifth. Remember that there are different types of literature in the Bible. There are different types. There are the prose and poetry. There are parables. There are laws. There are laments. And to discern what these different types of literature are will affect how we read. Not everything in the Bible is to be interpreted literally. Metaphors abound in the Bible. God is a rock, or God is a father. God is maggots, Hosea 5:12. Work with that one for a while. Jesus is the Lamb of God. We'll come back to metaphor some tomorrow. Seven, remember that not everything in the Bible, not everything reported in the Bible actually happened. Jesus' parables are fiction, yet they're true. Oftentimes we insist, if something didn't happen, we say, well, then it's not true. Well, truth can be conveyed through any type of literature, including fictional literature. So truth is not necessarily related to historicity. Eight, remember that we need to interpret every text in a context. The Bible passages do not have authority for our lives, sort of independent from texts that surround them. So we shouldn't read text in isolation from other texts. Nine, remember that not every text of the Bible has equal value for our faith and life. There are different texts have different values. Okay. Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And 1 Chronicles 9, Uz was the brother of Buzz. Difference in value for faith and life. Okay? But to try to sort out which texts do have more value than other texts do, and what criteria are you going to use to sort out the more or less valuable texts? And what key here becomes then certain centering texts. Jesus Christ is Lord. The death, life, death, and resurrection of Jesus becomes a center in terms of which we evaluate other texts. Or in the Old Testament, the Lord God is gracious, merciful, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love, becomes a center then for interpreting other texts. And finally, number 10, remember that Bible readers, we must be prepared to recognize that the Bible doesn't have a single point of view on all kinds of things. There are varying points of view on a range of issues here. And so when we try to sort of put it together for ourselves, sort of a biblical theological perspective, you know, we have to remember that we're always going to be doing some picking and choosing among texts. Certain texts are going to be more important for you than for me. And it's just the way it's going to be. So let's just recognize that. I work with God texts with you now over the next few days. I'm going to be picking and choosing certain texts and not picking and choosing other texts. And some of you may say, well, what about this text? Well, let's talk about it. Okay? We'll talk about it. But it's inevitable, just simply given the length and breadth of this material and the differences in points of view that are represented there, that we'll do a certain amount of picking and choosing. So, we could go into that a little bit more if you'd like along the way, but let's come now to more specific God stuff. What's at stake? And you're thinking about God. Several things. First of all, let me talk about what I think there's a close relationship between piety or spirituality and one's thinking about God. For some people I know, God is a red-hot inferno. Okay, I mean, it's before whom one simply prostrates oneself in fear and trembling. But that's the basic image, that's the basic piety with which they work. And I recognize that, I acknowledge that. I'd like to talk with that person a lot, okay? For me, God is not a red-hot inferno. I think that the basic stance before God ought not be fear and trembling. And what's fundamental for me there is the life of Jesus. The first word about Jesus that comes in the story of the shepherds on the hills is the angels appear to the shepherds and they say, "Don't be afraid." And one of the last things that Jesus said in the upper room with his disciples after the resurrection, coming to them, showing them his the prints in his hands and in his side, three times, "Peace be with you. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid." That reflects more my piety, my spirituality. I grew up in a parsonage, oldest of four boys, and my mom and my dad used to haul us into the family room after dinner every night, and we'd have family devotions, and it often went on for quite a while. And we were expected to read the Bible together. We were all expected to pray our prayers together. And over those years, there was a certain understanding of God that became apparent in this family. For my parents, who are still living, both graduates of the Lutheran Bible Institute, if you know something about that pietistic tradition, okay, for them, God, they were in genuine relationship with a God who was very close. It was like God was upstairs and the walls were paper thin. And talking with God was like having a conversation with your next door neighbor almost. And one of the things that I've sort of has taunted me, driven me over the years since, is what is that relationship with God that they've got going for them? Has it got a sound biblical grounding? I'm intrigued by the language of relationship, because it was such important language to them. Language of relationship with God. And I would invite you to think about relationship language. We're going to get into this more tomorrow. But is the relationship you've got with God, is it real? Is it a genuine relationship? Or is the relationship only perfunctory? We call it relationship, but it's not really relationship. Does God enter into relationship with you with integrity? Does what you do and say in the relationship count with God? What kind of relationship is it you have with this God in whom you believe? The kind of God in whom you believe will affect the dynamics, the ongoing dynamics of this relationship that you have. I think that relationship is central to how we think about God. And as we'll see, the primary metaphors that are used throughout the biblical material to think about God are relational in character. God is a parent. God is a spouse. You got an issue you want to think through about God, think about that relationship with God in terms of the relationship you might have with a parent or a spouse. You're invited into that kind of relational conversation by the use of all these biblical materials. So, relationship between piety, spirituality, and your imaging God, understanding of relationship, these are some issues that flow together for me. Another issue for me is, I've been teaching Old Testament for a long time, and I'm concerned about the bad press that the God of the Old Testament has out and about in many places in the life of the church. The God of the Old Testament is commonly conceived to be sort of an authoritarian God. Let's hit him, bash him over the head kind of God and be on with it. God of floods and fires and brimstone, and a God who strikes out in violent ways, it seems, again and again. How can I connect with that imaging of God? Well, part of the problem here, folks, is that there's an awful lot of Old Testament texts that simply are not attended to very well. We tend to lift up those few texts that have some really violent character to them, and focus in on them, and that becomes a problem for us. I'm not trying to set aside those texts. I think they continue to be a problem, and we'll note some of them along the way. I'd also like to invite you to think that the New Testament texts with regard to God have a comparable problem. It's in the New Testament that we learn that God sends people to hell where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth for an eternity. Okay? You don't learn about that in the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, you generally do not have a perspective of eternal life. In the Old Testament, generally, when you're dead, you're dead. Okay? In the New Testament, you get new eternal life into your theological ballgame, and all of a sudden, you get people sent to hell, and you got eternal violence at the hands of God. Eternal violence. That's a problem the New Testament has. I just want to sort of even-handedness. Okay. But I'm concerned. I'm concerned about this God, the God of the Bible and the God of the Old Testament, not least in this matter. Another thing I'm concerned about is the issues of evangelism, outreach, and the life, the mission of the church. And the importance of your thinking about God when it comes to evangelism, outreach, mission. I'm convinced. Now, see if this connects with your own experience. I'm convinced that one of the key stumbling blocks to the participation of many people in the life of the church is a notion of God. And under some understanding of God that they picked up along the way that has turned them off to the life of the church. And there's a certain image of God that keeps them away or on the periphery of our congregations. And this is pretty basic stuff for me. The question, what is it about the God of the church that keeps people away? Why aren't people attracted to the church because of the God in whom we believe? it's a kind of an issue of the attractiveness of God. I mean, one could misuse that phrase, but it's kind of interesting to think about. How can, my kind of question, how can one speak meaningfully of God today, you know, on the one hand, I take the Bible and the tradition seriously, responsibly into account. And on the other hand, I take human experience seriously into account, particularly the experience of evil and suffering. And a kind of, how can I keep the tradition and contemporary experience together? Elizabeth Johnson, who has a fine book entitled She Who Is, maybe some of you are familiar with that book. Page 15, she's speaking particularly here of the experience of women, but I think it applies more generally, these couple of sentences. She says, religions die when they lose the power to interpret convincingly the full range of present experience in the light of their idea of God. If the idea of God does not keep pace with developing reality, the power of experience pulls people on and the God dies, fading from memory. In other words, I think a lot of our traditional talk about God has become so disconnected from experience, from our actual experience, that God language is empty, it's stifling, it's obscure, it's boring. A lot of our hymns, just take one metaphor for a moment here. God is king. What's a king to you as a contemporary American? What do you think king? What do you think? We haven't had experience with kings or queens. Elvis, maybe, I don't know. But if you have, I mean, what comes to mind? Is it Caesar? Napoleon? Is it maybe the king of Sweden? The Queen of England, maybe. The Queen of England. I mean, wonderful pep talks, wonderful liturgical occasions. No, you know. But what comes to mind for you when you sing, "Oh, worship the King, all glorious"? What goes through your head? Is your King, your God who is King, is your God in absolute control of everything? Is that what King means? Is your God absolute monarch? What kind of relationship have you got with a King? Well, what is that language? What does that image mean? What does that language carry for you? What does it bear for you? You might say, well, God is one who rules, right? God rules. Well, what kind of rule? I mean, if God is ruler and we're all so unruly, God's a colossal management failure, huh? What does that language mean? You know, over the years, artists haven't attempted many images of God. A lot of images of Jesus out there. Not many of God. One of the most familiar images of God that's out there is the one in Sistine Chapel in Rome. Michelangelo's Creator God. You all have seen a picture of it. If you haven't seen it, you know, where the finger is pointing out to the not yet quite created Adam. And one of the interesting things is to look at the imaging of God that Michelangelo has there. What kind of God? And if one striking way to look at that is to look, just to compare the image of Adam and the image of God. And both of them are the same color skin. Okay? Both of them have a Roman nose. Okay? Both of them have the same muscle tone. Huh? Remarkable how Michelangelo has created a God in the image of an Italian male. And the Adam is completely unclothed, of course. God's got a little loincloth. But you know that if you were to pull the loincloth away, that there would be I would be a male god there. That this? We all do a remarkable amount of creating God in our own image. We have been created in God's image, we're told, but we do return the compliment. And that's inevitable. We're all going to be about the business because of who we are and our own experience of shaping certain basic images of God. And we do need help with one another in thinking these matters through. We can say too much about God. We need to remember, God outdistances all of our images. We can never sort of capture God in language or images or whatever. One can be immobilized by that observation. Okay, you can't capture God in all your images. You can't, sort of, God outdistances all of our talking about God and all our thinking about God. But that is not some kind of word to stop us in our track from further reflection. Jesus said that he would send the Spirit to lead us into all the truth. And that includes the truth about God. And we ain't there yet. We're still working on this. And we'll work on it together. Now, with regard to if our language, if there's such a disjunction, oftentimes, between our language about God and our present experience, I think that how that might affect outreach and evangelism, let me just think about that out loud a little bit with you here. Most of the language of the church about God is socially comfortable. Socially comfortable. Think about it. When's the last time God or God talk really got under your skin during worship service? Okay? And you go to somebody's door in a, let's say, a lower class neighborhood, and you knock on the door, and you're asked, well, what kind of God do you worship down there at Faith Lutheran Church? Well, will what emerges from your conversation, will it be sort of a socially comfortable God? Well, I don't want anything to do with that, God. Thank you very much. I mean, my life is an oppressed life. I'm the underclass here. Is your God any room for folks like us? Or oftentimes our images for God are authoritarian. And you come to a door, and you knock on the door, and they ask you what kind of God you're worshiping down in your church, and you start using the language of king, or you start using more authoritarian language for God. And this person said, well, we live in a democracy. I mean, the egalitarian order is the way things ought to be. I think the authoritarian images of God have led to a hierarchical structure in the life of the church and the life of society more generally. And I can do without hierarchy, thank you very much. Authoritarian images of God, is that difficult for some people, maybe many people? For 2,000 years, the church has used the language of for God of immovable, impassible. God has no feelings, God doesn't have emotions. And we're going to talk about this a little bit later on in the week, but. So you go to this door and somebody asks you about, I've heard that the God whom you worship is an impassible and immovable God who doesn't have emotions. Huh? And how will you respond? And what if they come back to you with a question like this? You mean your God could look into the face of a starving child and not be moved by that? Is that the kind of God you worship in your congregation? If that's the kind of God you got down there, I don't want anything to do with that God. If your God is not moved by the suffering of this world, by the suffering of children of all things, thank you very much, I'll go elsewhere. And power language for God. Really amazed sometimes how often the word Almighty appears in worship services and hymns. What do you think when you hear the word Almighty? We're going to talk a little bit about more of this later on this week, but You come to this person's door again. What kind of God do you worship? Omnipotent, all-powerful God, where we worship. Oftentimes, the response might be, well, your God's all-powerful. What about those who experience abusive forms of human power? Where's your God in those situations? Then you come to the door, and a father answers the door and says, my daughter was raped. Where was your God when that happened? Was your God just standing there, looking at the situation? Could have stopped it, but didn't? Is that the kind of God you got? Or if you take the Holocaust, there are millions of Jews and other people killed. You mean your God could have stopped it and didn't? You mean your God, just stood there, took it all in, burning human flesh days upon days upon days, and didn't stop it? Well, I mean, what kind of God is that? I'm sorry. That kind of God is not for me. Last October in the New York Times, beginning of the Jewish festival season, Elie Wiesel had a little prayer to God on the op-ed page of the New York Times, by the way. Part of it goes like this. Master of the universe, let us make up. It's time. How can we go on being angry? In my testimony, I've written harsh words, burning words about your role in our tragedy. I would not repeat them today, but I felt them then. I felt them in every cell of my being. Why did you allow, if not enable, the killer day after day, night after night, to torment, kill, and annihilate tens of thousands of Jewish children? Why were they abandoned by your creation? These thoughts were in no way destined to diminish the guilt of the guilty. I mean, their established culpability is irrelevant to my problem with you, Master of the Universe. In my childhood, I did not expect much from human beings, but I expected everything from you. Where were you, God of Kindness, in Auschwitz? What was going on in heaven, at the celestial tribunal, while your children were marked for humiliation, isolation, and death, only because they were Jewish? These questions have been haunting me for more than 5 decades. You have vocal defenders, you know. Many theological answers were given me, such as, God is God. I mean, he alone knows what he's doing. One has no right to question him or his ways. Or, Auschwitz was a punishment for European Jewry's sin of assimilation and or Zionism. Or, isn't Israel a solution? Without Auschwitz, there would have been no Israel. I reject all these answers. Auschwitz must and will forever remain a question mark only. It can be conceived neither with God nor without God. At one point, I began wondering whether I was not unfair with you. After all, Auschwitz was not something that came down ready-made from heaven. It was conceived by man, implemented by man, staffed by man, and that aim was to destroy not only us, but you as well. Ought we not think of your pain too? Watching your children suffer at the hands of your other children? Haven't you also suffered, O Master of the Universe? As we Jews now enter into the high holidays again, preparing ourselves to pray for a year of peace and happiness for our people and all people, let us make up, Master of the Universe. In spite of everything that happened, yes, in spite, let us make up for the child in me. It's unbearable to be divorced from you for so long. Powerful piece of writing. One more image for God that you might run into is, I think, maybe more common in the church, as I've picked it up over the years and getting out and about, is micromanagement language for God. Or we have language like, God is in control. God is in charge. We'll talk a little bit more about this, but it's sort of bumper sticker language for God. God's in control. That's a problem for a lot of people. This is an era in which science and health technology have helped explain an awful lot about how the world works. Where can we talk about the presence and activity of God in a world where everything seems capable of being explained in other terms? We don't need God to explain most of what's happened. And we sort of got God of the gaps, for a few things we don't yet understand. But we'll get there, folks. We'll get there. All right? Micromanagement for God? We tend to steer into one of two ditches. On the one hand, we get into the deistic ditch of God created the world, then went off into heaven, and is now sitting on the front porch of heaven watching the world go by. Isn't that interesting? Oh, isn't that nice? That's one ditch we get into. Kind of practical atheism. Well, God exists, but really doesn't make any difference as far as the going of my everyday life is concerned. That's common in the churches, I think, kind of practical atheism. On the other hand, you get the micromanagement God, the deterministic God, the God who's in absolute control of things. That's another ditch. Somehow we've got to find a way between these two ditches, hopefully over the next few days we can work at that a little bit. Traditional language for God, I think, doesn't often connect very well with contemporary experience, and it affects evangelism, outreach of the church. Press people over on the edges of our congregations. One of the most popular books in the last couple decades is by Rabbi Kushner, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Amazing how many Christians bought that book by that Jewish rabbi and found it helpful in a variety of ways. And one of the reasons perhaps why they found that helpful is that they didn't find as much help within the church or within the congregation in dealing with questions of this kind. In the Chicago Tribune a few years ago, there was an interesting article by Michael Hursley, used to be the religion writer for the Chicago Tribune. He went to an interfaith forum in Winnetka, which is one of the plush suburbs on the north side of Chicago, and after a tragedy in the community, and he just listened to some of the things he reports on a session that Martin Marty had in this interfaith forum. Last May 20th, things were overturned in Winnetka, and Laurie Dan shot and killed 8-year-old Nicholas Brent Corwin and shot and wounded a half dozen others in a spree that ended when she killed herself. And until that day, the quiet North Shore suburb had not witnessed a homicide in Dan's 30-year lifetime. The eyes of the world have been upon you, Marty told those who came to a special interfaith forum on suffering and the search for meaning. All of us have a sense that the groundwork of the earth has shifted. Turning to God can be discouraging, he said candidly, because God is perceived as the giver of the groundwork, and suddenly the groundwork shifts. And God is perceived as the great exemptor, and suddenly you're not exempted. And he traced a litany of God language that can intensify the wound of tragedy. And here's your list. 1, God caused it. 2, God was absent that day. 3, God could have prevented it, but didn't. Or, God was preoccupied. Or, God no longer cares. Even clergy members can aggravate the pain, he said, relating what a clergyman told friends of his after one of their children was killed in a freak accident in a ski resort parking lot. Someday you'll know what you did to cause this to happen. The mother involved, Marty said, never set foot in a church again. The implications of your God. What kind of God do you believe in? As a teacher of seminarians, I'm concerned about styles of leadership in the church and the kind of leaders, pastors, and other religious leaders will be over these next years. I'm convinced that the images of God that pastors have shape their styles of leadership. And I'm after that question in seminary classrooms. If, in fact, the primary image of God for somebody is that their God is judge, then judging and evaluating is going to be a big part of one's leadership style. I think willy-nilly, Deuteronomy tells us, walk in all of God's ways, and if your God is an imperious God, you're going to be an imperious leader. So I'm concerned about, I think there's been some rediscovery of neglected images of God. It's very nice to see that in the chapel last evening. It'll take time in terms to affect leadership patterns in the church. But there are some important issues here. And finally, let me raise one other question and then open it up. I'm concerned about the images of God for children. And the way in which the minds and the hearts of children are shaped in their contact with the church, whether it be through Sunday school lessons, through pastoral and other church leadership. I commend a little book to you by David Heller entitled The Children's God, written about a decade ago. It's a study of 40 children from various denominations, and he works with children and from ages 4 to 12, tries to elicit from them their images for God. And he works with writing letters to God, talking over the phone with God, interviewing God, in a whole variety of such ways of trying to get at this. And one of the scary things about his survey is the extent to which parental behaviors or other authority figures, religious authority figures in the life of these children has shaped their images of God. And one of the basic perceptions is that those in leadership positions in the church tend to block unconventional questions about God. Or they've got the sure thing, down pat kind of response, take it or shut up. And means, I think, not uncommonly, is that kids quit asking the questions, and it just goes inside them. My daughter, who's in the area of art and design, has said to me, apparently it's about in some book she read, that most people have an artistic ability of a 12-year-old. And that is, and why is that? Well, it's about age 12, where the kids became increasingly sensitive of what other people thought of what they were doing, their drawing. And hence gradually withdrew and didn't develop further in view of the response they were getting. I think most people in the church probably have a theology of about a 12-year-old. By that I'm suggesting is that the tendency in the church has been to discourage questions, to come through with, you've got to have everything down pat and everything in shape, so that kind of blocking of unconventional understandings or unconventional approaches to theological issues. And so people then just shut up, go with inside themselves, and work it out in some kind of independence of the life of the church, or shut off the church altogether. What are we doing to our children in terms of developing their images of God? Kind of interesting, Hugh Downs and Barbara Walters in the program 2020 picked up on some of David Heller's work about 10 years ago. And they did some interviewing of kids themselves. And I just happened onto the program and I wrote for the transcript, and it's really intriguing. Some of the ways in which they, let me just read a couple of these and then let's open it up. The psychologists say that the open debates about God, this is the moderator now, happen by the time the child is 10 or 11 years old. Because by this age, the kids know we parents don't have all the answers. It's much earlier than 10 or 11, I think. And instead of just accepting a good, all-knowing God, these kids, here's one, Kimberly. Are you a real person? Is it true that you really made the earth, the water, and the people? Why should I believe in you? Here's Kevin. Why do we have to die and work and go to school? I think at an ascending level of importance. Why couldn't we be born equal and have no bad people? Here's Kimberly. God, why do you let tragedies happen if you're so powerful? Why do you let accidents happen? Why do you let people get diseases? I probably won't understand, but please write back. Or, here comes the moderator again. Do you have any doubt that God exists? No, I think well, sometimes. Like, once in a while when something bad really happens. And here's Kevin, again. God can create things, but he can't control them so well. Like, he can create men and women and, you know, put them on earth, but he can't control so much what they do. Isn't that wonderful? I'm your old talking. Your Sunday school materials hit on something? I mean, can they handle that one? Here's one. I think that when God put people on the earth, he had to leave some things up to chance. That's a sophisticated theological position there, actually. Any room in your church for chance? Let's talk about it a little bit. What I want to do over the next several days now is get us into some texts, Old Testament texts about God, and begin to fill out what I would hope to be it's more highly relational God than the one that you're used to thinking about. Work at that a little bit. But this is an effort to kind of show you what's at stake here. There's a lot at stake here.
Okay. Oh. C.S. Lewis, in his Surprised by Joy, what he was doing was describing his struggle throughout his life from childhood with images of God. And he sort of arrived at one by process of elimination.
Oh, okay. And?
I think it touches on so many of these things because he wrote so much about images that he was given as a child and how he tried to deal with them. Well, the secret must be to pray a lot. So he got obsessive about praying a lot for a couple of years. And then he said, well, that's not working. So he threw that away.
Interesting. Do you happen to know right off the top of your head, is there a work where he kind of chronicles that particular journey, or is it just in bits and pieces?
Surprised by Joy.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Other comments, questions here? Yes, please.
You used the word piety earlier on, and I guess I
used the word
piety.
Oh, yeah.
And okay. I've heard that defined in a number of different ways. Would you give us your definition?
It's not a common word much anymore. We tend to use the word spirituality spiritual formation, language of that kind, perhaps. I suppose in my own personal story, piety is deeply connected with two things. One is sort of one's devotional life, one's reading, personal reading of the Bible and praying, whether highly disciplined or not. And on the other hand, public participation in public worship, where one gathers with the larger community in prayer, hymns, and so forth. So I would associate the language of piety with those two dimensions. Though I suppose if you were to go back into a study of pietism, it would be the more personal dimension of that that would be lifted up and given special attention. It's very interesting, having been a part now of 30 years of seminary students, and having come into the seminary in 1968 at the height of the 60s, brought issues, Vietnam War issues and so forth, and how sort of students did their theology on the streets, very active shape to their religious life. And how in the 70s, students kind of moved back inward and became more reflective and more interested in prayer and these dimensions of Christian faith and life. There's some sort of cycles, I think, that individuals, churches, go through with regard to interest and attention to such matters. And I guess one thing might be said generally is I think maybe this is a merge for most people, there's no one shape that piety ought to have, that people, depending upon who they are, the communities to which they belong, their own experiences and so forth, will shape their lives in different ways. Yes, Mark?
I was wondering if you just unpack a little bit more your thought about connecting the images of God to our experience. I'm interested in the character of that connection. Sometimes, as you spoke, it looked as though the connection was, in a way, one that was so close that people felt comfortable with it, i.e. you said, I think, kind of critically, that in many of our churches, the images of God are socially comfortable. Mm-hmm. And then you went on to suggest that, in a way, what those churches often need is a word that afflicts the comfortable, more than comforts the afflicted, and so that the image of God, in a way, is connected to experience, in a way, over and against it. I mean, you could argue that some churches are flourishing precisely because the nature of their connection between images of God and experience is that God becomes a kind of ratifier of all of the kind of greed and the impulses and so forth that they have. So if you could talk just a little bit more about the character of this connection between experience and images of God, that would be helpful.
As you know, that's a big, big topic, and I don't know if I can say too much more here that's helpful, but I think it's possible, say, in those churches where the God in whom they believe simply is in the business of ratification of all that they think most highly of or do and say, I think it's possible for people in such situations to integrate all of their experience somehow into that particular pattern. And so, in effect, if they have a contrary experience or whatever, they find a way to think, God's testing me, or God is disciplining me. What did I do wrong? God is punishing me. There are a variety of ways in which that contrary experience can be integrated into a single story here. For a lot of people, that doesn't work. That becomes simply too easy to sort of take all contrary experience and think about it and try to work it out in those terms. Those experiences become much more disjunctive for some people. The God with whom they've grown up, the God with the church has taught them to believe over the years, just doesn't connect very well. Now, in my lifting up of the disconnections, the disjunctive language, I think that there are many people out there for whom there are no disconnections. I mean, it just, experience is not disjunctive for them. They work it out somehow, they integrate it. But for many others, I think this proves to be the case. So it's a complex reality. You want to come back some on that, Mark?
No, I think it's just it's a very complicated question, as you suggested, and you said right at the very beginning, this wanting to be faithful to the tradition and at the same time responsive to the shifting experiences. How to negotiate that is, I guess, what your week will be about. But it requires, as you said at the beginning, a lot of kind of collective discernment on these matters, because it's an ongoing, it never comes to an end.
Right. It never comes to an end.
There's always got to be, though, I think, some tension. That is, there's always got to be, and this is a Lutheran, it can't be ever too tidy. When the connection between the word and our experience gets too tidy, too comfortable, something is wrong. We probably erred too far on the side of experience and not been open to the word of judgment and the word of...
I think one can err on either side there. Yeah. One can err too much on the side of experience, where everything's up in the air always, Okay, or one can err too much on the side of tradition, so that experience never informs tradition. The tradition was set back in the first century BC, as we interpret it, and any contrary experience somehow needs to be integrated into that picture.
Yeah.
And I think both of those are possible, and I think both of them are not helpful. Mm-hmm. I think they're both ditches out there.
I was also going to go to the other side of Mark's question to call attention to the fact that you're using the phrase the image of God rather than God's identity or who God is. There's a sort of distancing in that phrase, the image of God, which isn't the same as who God is precisely. It's more who we see God. Mm-hmm. It's our seeing of God, our... almost as though God stands, well, Luther's language would be more the masks that God shows us, which with Zarco here at the mask maker might be a good opportunity for us to think about that mask business. But I hope that as we look at those texts, we'll come back to the phrase itself, the image of God. Are you choosing that intentionally rather than saying who God is?
Tomorrow I'm going to talk about metaphors some, and some of the predominant metaphors that the biblical materials have to present to us, and some of the not, you know, some of the infrequent ones which are striking in their own way. And we will, I think all language about God is metaphorical, and I think all metaphors have a yes and a no. God is like this and God is not like this. Kind of everything that one says about God has that tension within it. But I do want to say this, Dan. I don't know if we'd be. I do want to say I think that there is some continuity between the metaphor and the reality of God.
Right. So that we can't just pick any metaphor.
Right.
That's the point. Given what you've said so far, the thing that you haven't said as much is if there is a God. God is somebody, something, so that suggests some limits to what images one might have.
I think there are some images which are more helpful than others in our attempt to understand who God is and what God is about. One of the interesting questions would be whether there are any images which are off limits. I think there maybe are some. But it's kind of interesting, you know. One of the first images I thought of being off limits is God is a crook. Now see, doesn't it? Then all of a sudden, Jesus said he will come like a thief in the night. Wow. Okay. God is a crook. They got to work with that a little bit. You understand? And we'll say a little bit more tomorrow. There's that's has to do somewhat with the socially comfortable languages. Is some of the images are so startling, so surprising, and so seeming they're at least in our way we think they're disjunctive from any God in whom we believe. We might think, that kind of language. Is important, I think, because it subverts, it sort of,
right.
It gets under the skin and so forth.
Because it then conveys a truth,
right,
which is truth relative to who God is, as well as relative to our experience, so that there are those two, I mean, you've talked about them as dangers, the two ditches that you don't want to fall into, but they're also the two, in communication, you want accuracy and effectiveness.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want just effective and no accuracy, you don't want just accuracy and no effectiveness.
Right, yeah, helpful. Good. Yes, you have a question, and then we need to maybe wrap it up here.
I'm not an interpreter right now, I'm just a participant. One of the things you said earlier that really caught my attention, there were three little points that kind of came together for me that was very important, especially as I've been worshiping in the deaf community for many years. One is we, and I can't even remember your exact words, but we cannot limit God, basically, in our language.
Right.
Our language use limits God, it tends to.
Yep.
And second, you brought out the point of missionary. Well, deaf churches, historically, are missions, correct? So as we come to this communication today, or this dialogue, or all week, our perspective then comes from what we have been led to understand as the images, as the identity, but in a very restrictive listening position. Because the power of language that has been brought to our community has been translated, has been limited, okay? And so our perspective is going, this conversation is thrilling for me, because in terms of a liberation theology, and one understands that we cannot limit this image of God, and knowing that here's two languages, well, more than two languages, but let's just for the moment say English and American Sign Language, and all the cultures from the historical Jesus and the history of the Old Testament brings us to today going, well then, who is this God that we worship? And so this is an exciting series that you're leading us for.
Good. That's very helpful for you to lift up that there is this sign language which is there, which is another level of interpretation. Another, you see, you're using your own images to convey the understanding of God to others. It's important. We need to quit for today. Tomorrow we talk about a God of relationships and lift up certain texts that speak of that. Thank you for today.
Thank you.